except for eggnog.
Major Jefferson, Reel 1. Could you tell me when you joined the army and why you joined it?
Well, may I begin by saying that I'm not known as Major Jefferson these days, because I joined the army in 1938 as a terrier. I was commissioned into the Manchester Artillery, and although I ended up commanding a battery for 2 years, I was a weekend soldier. I was a weekend soldier, I think, because at that time, having left Rossall, where I had got a Cert A, as one would expect, I was an actuarial student in Manchester, and one of my fellow students was a chap called Murfin, who was already, I think, a captain. Certainly he had two pips. He was a bit further down the military road and the actuarial road than I was. And Norman Murfin, known as Muffin, was a weekend soldier with the Manchester Artillery, which was and still has an old comrades association of chaps who served in the 52nd Field Regiment, RATA. And I think that one of the reasons I joined was that I admired Norman Murfin. I think another reason was that I could see that war was coming, and I thought it would be more comfortable and perhaps even less dangerous, though I think I perhaps made a mistake there, but certainly more comfortable to be an officer in the gunners than a conscript in the infantry.
Was there any tradition of military service in your family?
My brother joined up in the ranks, but that was later. No, not in... That's a difficult question to answer, because, of course, I had two uncles who were killed in the Great War. But no, we weren't a family who always, from father to son to grandson, provided people for the army, no.
How did your parents react to the news that you were joining up as a terrier?
I'm not even certain that I told them. I lived in Manchester and they lived in Derbyshire. I'm pretty certain that if I got any reaction other than fear, it would be approbation, because both of them were strong in good works. So I'm quite certain they approved. Although I'm equally certain that they were a bit frightened. But I was the youngest of a brood of four, and by many years the youngest, so I suppose I was spare.
You said that you could see the war coming. Can you remember when it was and why it was that you thought a war was likely, and when it was and why it was that you thought a war had become unavoidable?
Oh, likely. It must have been in summer 38, and was certainly due to... Was the word Gdansk mean anything in connection to 38? The Danish corridor? Gdansk. Polish corridor. Is that 38? No, I can't remember clearly, but I do know that in 1938 I thought war was likely, certainly by late 38, and by mid 39 I knew it was certain. And peace ended for me. I can tell you exactly the hour. It was 4 o'clock on Friday the 1st of September 1939, when I was in the refuge insurance company with my high desk. It was literally one of these high clerical things.
A Dickens.
Yes, and it was very Dickensian in atmosphere inside. And the departmental manager came along at just after four and said, the TA's been mobilised. And I left Oxford Street, Manchester, on a train went out to sail. I was back in Ardwick in uniform by 6 o'clock, and stayed in uniform till 1946.
Can you remember if you had any conception of how the war might develop in a strategic way, of what sort of strategy and tactics the enemy might use?
None whatsoever, and I don't know that one was necessarily interested. I had thought as a boy, as a young lad of 15, 16, I knew that on my 18th birthday I was going to be given a stick and told to march into barbed wire and be machine gunned down. I mean, that was, I was surprised when my 18th birthday passed and that happened. That hadn't happened. Because, of course, in those days one read G.A. Henty with the tanks of the Somme, and I knew that was likely to be our fate. But I can't say that I was... politically, I think that I do believe in those days we had standards that you expected if you made a promise to keep it. And I suppose that's perhaps in one sense why I knew that war was inevitable. But tactics, strategy certainly didn't interest me, and tactics was whether one could get 24-hour pass or not.
Do you remember whether or not you foresaw war against Italy as well as against Germany?
No. What one thing I do remember from those days, and I've been waiting for someone to quote it in the Times recently, I'm sure that somewhere at that time I saw a headline that said, Russia joins the Anti-Comintern Pact. And that gave me a great deal of amusement. But politics and strategy were not things that that I remember, at least, worrying about. I do remember worrying about the Maginot Line and whether it would hold and that sort of thing, but that wasn't on the strategic level, that was simply on the Save Jefferson level.
How did you find yourself in the Western Desert?
Well, my Terrier Regiment went to France and left via Dunkirk, and we reformed up at Hexham in Northumberland, and then early September 40 we started moving down south. It was the night of Cromwell, which I think will be September the 15th, though it may have been September the 8th, 1940, and I was going to have a lovely night in London. I put into Regent Palace, or Strand Palace, and noticed that I was sitting under a wall of glass, and I went off to my course, which was a chemical warfare course at Porton Down, where I defended England with gas shells. And the last day of the course, I used to be fairly intelligent in those days, but the last day of the course they asked me a question about phosgene, and I gave the correct answer, and about mustard gas, and I gave the correct answer, because of course the treatment for mustard and phosgene is diametrically opposed. And then they asked me the standard question of what if it's mustard mixed with phosgene, and I couldn't deny myself the pleasure of saying I would try the strength of silent prayer. And as a result, when I got back I had a D from my gas course. And a few days later, the CO had to divide his survivors from Dunkirk into three, one third to stay with the regiment, one third to go up to a second line, must be the third line by now, and one third to go to India. And with my D from the gas course, I got on the India boat. And I arrived in India in March 41. From India, we went across to Iraq, the regiment invaded Iran. I went to hospital with several different tropical diseases, spent that winter mostly in hospital, had a very pleasant leave early in 42 in Beirut, which was then a beautiful city. And when we got back on June the 9th, 1942, I was up in the hills of Kurdistan and building what was meant to be a rest camp for the regiment to have a bit of a holiday in. And that, of course, was an inevitable sign for a recall. And on June the 12th, 1942, the regiment moved from Altun Kupri on the Lesser Zahab, about 10 miles north of Kirkuk. I think it's about 10 miles north of Kirkuk. I'd have to check that on the map. And we marched. We left Baghdad on the 15th of June. I was the advance party across the desert, chasing 1,000 Palestinian ATS. Never caught up with them. And we got to Cairo on the 23rd of June. We left Cairo on the 26th of June. By now, of course, the 9th of June, our recall date, that was just after four regiments of guns had been wiped out at Gazala. Yeah? And our arrival in Cairo was just after further regiments had been wiped out in the Gazala Gallop. So by now the regiment was pretty low in guns in the desert. And we marched off towards Matru. I would like to interpolate, because I think it's relevant to what we were talking about earlier, this fact that we were ordered from the northern flank, the Orc's northern flank. I mean, we know from all his writing that he was worried about that northern flank, and he pulled at least three regiments of artillery and a brigade of infantry across, 18th Indian Brigade. When they did get to El Alamein, if those hadn't been there, I am absolutely convinced, and I have a great deal of written and verbal evidence to support it, there would have been no Battle of El Alamein. Yeah? So if ever you get any information about that decision of the Orcs, I'd be very grateful if you remember me, because I'm anxious to get further insights into that. Well, we arrived in Mersin Matru on the evening of the 27th of June, and as we got there, the advance German forces must have just opened the road to let us in, in fact, because within a very short time of our arriving at Sidi Hanesh, which is just short of Mersin Matru, there were unfriendly noises behind us. We lagered off the road that evening. The CO reported to the GOC 50 Div, Crasher Nichols, and received a rocket for being half an hour late after marching 1,500 miles. That is a fact that I know from Major General Douglas Brown, who was then his brigade major. That night we were ordered to leave our B echelon in the sands just short of Matru. And then I did one thing that I've been grateful for ever since. Because when we came from India, I had joined this regular regiment, and we brought fair supplies with us, but my battery commander, Anthony Stanton, who is today a Major General, lives near Hexham in Northumberland, but Anthony was my battery commander in the months before June 42. He left us to go to Haifa Staff College, just before these events that I'm now talking about. But Anthony had rationed us to 2 pegs a night for a year in Iraq. And just before leaving Matru, I'm glad to say that I got one of those bottles of whiskey, and it accompanied me on the breakout, and I think that my memories of the breakout might be clearer, but would certainly be less happy if I hadn't had that bottle of whiskey from the mess tent, mess truck.
Were the pegs Chota pegs or Burra pegs?
In Iraq, I think Anthony was a bit mean, actually, but I'm quite certain we tried to make them Burra pegs.
Can I ask you how you found the regulars compared to your territorial regiment?
Well, arriving in India as a terrier, of course, in 1941 was quite an interesting experience. The reason we'd been sent there was because we'd heard things go bang, and they hadn't.
This must have been an odd contrast with the normal state of affairs, where you would expect regulars to be more experienced in fighting than
And
terriers.
I knew bits about the artillery board that they hadn't reached them yet. And as a result, I was immediately made a captain. Unfortunately, I didn't keep my pit very long because I then lost my copper book another way. But the contrast was interesting because not only was it a regular regiment and weekend soldiers, but there were also Calcutta Jute Wallahs, who'd been through Belgaum, through the Octu there. And, of course, the regulars were all landed gents, fairly impoverished, but landed gentry.
Younger sons.
Yes, and very strong on pig-sticking. I just mentioned Anthony Stanton. The night I arrived, I should never forget being ushered into Anthony's bungalow, and there was this 6-foot-something, extremely handsome chap with a red face and dark eyebrows. He'd looking just like as though he'd come from Hollywood, dressed in white riding kit, standing on a tiger's head. And he frightened the daylights out of me. Literally, he looked like Ronald Coleman or something like that. Then there were the terriers, and we were well trained. And we'd seen action. We knew the latest in gadgetry. We had, at least I had, I'm glad to say, my blue patrols, so I was able to dress like a gentleman. But I'm not very fond of horses. And when I arrived, they still had horses. I had to do one tour as orderly officer and go round and grunt at the damn things. And I hate horses. But then there were the Jute Wallahs, most of whom were in receipt of quite large private incomes from their firms out there, yeah? The weekend soldiers and the Jute Wallahs eventually got a bit tired about listening to when I was at the shop. And Jimmy Brecknell, who was the battery captain on the 27th of June 42, who got left in Matru, in fact. But I shall never forget Jimmy in 1941 turning to one of the regulars and who started talking about when we were at the shop and saying, excuse me, sir, which shop? Knocking? Bucket? Or thee? And that rather neatly sums up their attitude to military affairs.
It sounds as though there was a certain amount of social friction in the regiment as a result of the different backgrounds of the officers.
No, I don't think Social friction is far too strong a word. There were three different types of beast there who got on pretty well together, but only met socially, intellectually, economically. That we only overlapped part of the way each time. Yeah? There was enormous regimental pride, because Fritz Fowler, the colonel, who later became the lieutenant before the events of the time, before we got into action properly, he became CRA of 1st Armoured Div. And Fritz Fowler is a very famous gunner and soldier and horseman. And I was fortunate. 2 years later, I took over non-troop, which had been some years back, 83rd Battery, and I was always through my line, streets ahead of anyone else, because it had been Frizz Fowler's old battery, and in the old days, Frizz used to walk around with a, I forget what the apparatus was called, a Don 7 probably, with a safety pin and pin into the line, and go around with a map case and bash people over the head if they were saying the wrong things down the telephone line. So 11th Field was a regiment that was very proud of itself. I mean, Anthony Stanton, that I just mentioned, he was a famous horseman and did well in the Carter Cup. I don't think he won it, but Friar Tuck, who did win it, had just left the regiment, if I remember right. And even though I hated horses, I was very proud of the fact that the regiment did well in the Carter Cup. And equally, though they didn't understand my mathematics, they were glad to have someone there who did mathematics. So I wouldn't talk of friction, but there was good humour banter, anyway. But the troops, of course... India at that time offered enormous opportunities for athletics. We had an athletic sports day, and I played cricket. Well, I made a few runs on that particular occasion. That didn't do anyone any harm with the troops. And equally, one of my sergeants did pretty well in the 800, and that didn't do any harm with me. But we only partially overlapped in our interests, whereas the regulars, of course, totally overlapped with each other in their interests.
Did you find any dramatic differences in the way in which the officers conducted their relations with the other ranks, as between TA regiments you'd been in and the regulars?
I don't think I did. I suppose the major difference, of course, was that Meerut was a military cantonment, and therefore everybody lived on military property, whereas in Manchester, chaps came in from Eccles. Yeah? And clearly, with troops living in an Indian cantonment, there. The orderly officer has worries about hygiene. We used to inspect the ice making machine very avidly, I remember. One has worries about the morals of the troops and their wives and their girlfriends, and the officers and their wives, and that man. And of course, our standards were very different in those days to what they would be today, or at least what I imagine they are today. I think there was an equal degree of what I would regard as enlightened paternalism, maybe a bit of old-fashioned thought that, but. I mean, the Indian troops, for instance, they literally said, "You are my mom, Bob, my mother and my father." And anyone who's seen the Gurkhas, because the Gurkha officer is the mother and father, you will very seldom find a bad Gurkha officer. Yeah.
Was the style of discipline more formal?
Well, the style of everything was more formal than it is today, of course, but judged between the two, no, I think, if anything, the terriers, I think we were just as keen to put on our blue patrols as a terrier as we were in Meerut. In fact, more so in a sense, because in Meerut you were a fairly common sight, whereas in Manchester you were a fairly uncommon sight.
You said that you were more advanced in the regiment in Britain in your equipment and presumably in method than they were in India. What were the principal areas where you were ahead?
Well, we had had 25 pounders longer. I remember that there was some little gadget that you put on the artillery board. I can't remember what it did, but I remember this. I remember Fritz Fowler being terribly impressed when the document arrived in India, and I was able to interpret it for him. Yeah? But as an example of the type of thing, I've just been reading this about Iraq. We had a compression. I can probably find it quickly enough to quote this particular thing, but I've just been reading it. Beg your pardon, I haven't. Switch off again. The answer is that in May 1941, the regiment received new 25 pounders in India. They received them with trailers, but unfortunately without handbooks, tools, or toolboxes. And in later in Iraq, one gun needed new packings, and it was then discovered that there were no 25-pounder spare parts in Iraq. So that was where we were one up on them. We'd been using the damn things, and we knew how to operate them. And they were still fairly new toys to a regiment that had been horse-drawn. Indeed, the tractors we first got in India had an enormous tendency to turn over.
Were these the quad tractor?
Yes, quads. I can tell you the exact type if you're interested later. Life in India, when we first got there in March 41, was still... the war hadn't really broken out.
Was it a tremendous cultural shock to you to be in India for the first time?
Wasn't a shock,